Welcome to the Pro Basketball Talk podcast. I'm Dan Feldman. I'm very glad today to be joined by Dan Devine of The Ringer, who does an excellent job covering the NBA, but especially for this podcast, is someone I know is passionate about not just the championship chase, who cares about other NBA storylines, everything going on in the league. So I want to talk about a certain class of teams. I think you have your five championship favorites, consensus-wise at least, the Suns, the Warriors out west, and in the east you have the Bucks, the Nets, and the 76ers now that they have James Harden. But there are eight other teams that, per the Ringer's playoff odds, have at least a 98% chance of making the playoffs. Those are the teams I want to talk about today. In the East, that's the Heat, the Bulls, the Cavaliers, and the Celtics. And in the West, it is the Grizzlies, the Jazz, the Mavericks, and the Nuggets. And we're going to rank those eight teams by how confident we are in them going through the rest of this year, obviously, mostly through the playoffs. These teams have been good in the regular season. They're not getting that championship hype that maybe they deserve, maybe they don't, maybe they're appropriately rated. They're having really good regular seasons, and that's something. So I want to talk more about them and how we see them going forward for the rest of the year. So we're going to rank those teams 1 through 8. Dan, once again, thanks for coming on. I'll start off. Let's go least confidence in to most confidence.
Well, hold on, Dan. Before you get into it, I just have to say, I have to give you credit for this, because what you've kind of managed a bank shot here. You're like, listen, we're not gonna talk only about the same five teams that everybody else talks about. But what you've done is construct a situation in which we are going to talk about that other class of teams and still insult the fan bases of seven of them. Like, we're still going to come out of this being like, yeah, they mentioned us, but they don't believe in us. And I think that's really a neat trick. Like, oh, you wanted the attention. Well, you've made a wish on a cursed monkey's paw here, because now we're going to talk about your teams and you're going to come away from it being like, but they're not the most confident in us. So really, What wonderful interneting that you've done here. Congratulations.
Can I work around it by saying, well, you're not in the play-in conversation podcast. Like, that's coming later. And you could have made that. Like, if we really didn't believe in you, if we thought, like, oh, they're going to fall apart and not even necessarily make the playoffs, you could be in that whole other podcast.
That's true. All right, that's fair. You know what? I like the way you middled that. That was very nicely done.
All right, well, I'm going to try and say some nice things about the team I have eight. I'm going to really try my best. And the team is the Cleveland Cavaliers. I am a big, big fan of watching the Cavs. I love what they're doing. They play hard. They play together. They have way more depth than I thought. Kevin Love is having a sixth man of the year type season. I don't have to go on and on about their young core of Darius Garland, Evan Mobley, Jared Allen. Garland is already a star. Allen was an all-star this year, not undeserved. Mobley might even have the best future of all three. I love how he's coming as a rookie. The balance is good. A great coaching job. I did not expect their oversized front line to work this well. It has. But I also see a team that is a little inexperienced for the playoffs, that there could be a shock there. And some of those things that work so well in the regular season, I hate saying this. I really do. I love to just say they play really hard as a compliment. But in the playoffs, everybody plays hard. You lose some competitive advantage on that. I'm a big believer in the Cavs. I wouldn't be surprised if they, won a playoff series. I might be surprised at two. These are teams I like. But of all these teams that I like, there's a class of teams I like. I'm going to say that again. But of all of them I like the Cavs just a little less in terms of what they can do in the playoffs. But in some ways, that's more of a credit to how they're overachieving in the regular season. All right, what team did you hate the most?
I like the way that was positioned. I also had the Cavs at 8.
Do you hate Cleveland?
Well, I was going to say this works out really well, because right before All-Star reserves, right? Right before the All-Star starters were announced, and I'm lucky enough to have a vote for All-Star starters, so I published my column of who I picked and why. So right before the most recent piece before that, I had written a big thing about Darius Garland. It was like, here's how sensational Darius Garland has been. And then when I had to make my All-Star starters picks, Darius Garland was not on the list. So Cleveland fans, wonderful Cleveland fans, were like, he loves us, he hates us. And it was kind of, right in close proximity to one another. Why I Hate the Cavaliers by Dan Devine, my book report. I think it goes back to Garland. It goes back to, they are so dependent on him for shot creation. They score like a top 10 offense with him on the court, but a bottom 5 offense when he's off of it. And that was kind of the whole idea of We make the Caris LeVert trade, and we have another creator, another guy who can pressure the rim, get us into our sets, whether or not he's in the second unit all the time or he takes Isaac Okoro's spot in the starting lineup. I mean, personally, I kind of liked the look of it when he was off the bench rather than going into the starting lineup. I thought it balanced things out better. But, we're seeing it right now where Garland's out and Caris LeVert is out, and they just really don't have enough high-level creation. Brandon Goodwin had a nice night against the Wolves the other night, but they were down 20-something and had to claw their way back just to fall short again. And between LeVert and Rondo and Goodwin and, like, you know, point Jetty Osman and whatever else kind of solutions they're trying to throw at the wall, I'm just not sure they've got enough sort of shot generation and bankable offense outside of what Garland can give them. And if you're relying on him, I mean, he's got to play like 40 plus minutes in a playoff series. He's young, he can do that, and he's excellent. But, you know, teams are going to make you play left-handed in the playoffs. And I think that's where they might find themselves like one creator short of being able to make a deep run. So that was kind of the thought process that I had with them. And now I'll never be allowed to go to Central Ohio again.
You know, I'm a little disappointed in how Caris LeVert has worked out so far, and obviously tiny sample size, but I wasn't the most confident going in. He's underwhelmed on that. I'm surprised how his NBA career has unfolded, you know, having watched him at Michigan. He's become such a gunner, fitting in with the team offense. I thought he'd be more of that secondary playmaker that you're talking about. I just don't think he can, like, snap that back. It's hard to go from the gunner he's been into that. He could do it some for them. I'd like them more if they still had Ricky Rubio. Sure. Colin Sexton was not that secondary creator, but would provide some help in other areas. One caveat I'll say, and this is a small sample because they've had, you know, guys in and out of the lineup and playing who, you know, maybe won't make the playoff rotation. Obviously, all those Ricky Rubio minutes, all the chemistry they had with him are out the window. But if you just look at the guys you project to be in their playoff rotation, they've played pretty well when those guys are on the court. That's one of the things I like to look at, is how is the chemistry of those top guys. It's been really good. Again, I think some of this is effort and going to disappear, but they have been very good with their top players.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they're sort of the inverse. There are teams that we'll talk about where so much of it is going to be they can get their shots against pretty much anybody, but can they get enough stops on the back end? They're the inverse of that. I believe that their defense is going to keep them in games. The way that they can protect the rim with both Allen and Mobley. Lowry, Markkanen, I'm with you. I was a real skeptic about how the three big looks. First off with Lowry, Markkanen starting, but then also with Love, or, you know, introducing Dean Wade as a kind of a big wing, sort of the role that Larry Nance played last year. You know, how those bigger looks would hold up. And they've been pretty much rock solid all year. So that defense is going to give them a chance to be in games. But it's so much of what it comes down to is, over the course of a seven-game series, a two-week sort of boot camp there, like, the other team's going to scout out what you want to do. They're going to find whatever small weaknesses and, you know, like the exhaust ports in the Death Star kind of thing. They're going to pick out those areas to exploit you. You need to be able to do that on the other end with them. And I'm interested to see how much on the offensive end JB Bickerstaff can get mismatches with the size. You know, are they going to be able to pound a smaller opponent inside with Allen, with Mobley? Are they going to be able to stretch enough with Love, with Markkanen? I'm a little skeptical about them being able just to do that enough offensively to hold up when another team's being able to poke holes in them on the other end.
Right. I agree. You know, I think it was a little understated how well going big works in the regular season. And it's a little weird how it's working for the Cavs. A lot of it is, you wall off the paint, which they do a great job of. But some of it is, like, you're just going to get more rebounds, which they don't do a great job of. But it is exploitable. But, you know, Jared Allen moves his feet pretty well for his size. Evan Mobley moves his feet very well for any size. Sure. Markkanen, I think, is going to be a little bit more of the weak spot. But maybe there are moments where you can, you know, take advantage of Allen having to operate in this space where there's all this other size. I think teams are going to be able to create more. I think this is what you're saying, right? Teams are going to be able to create more matchup advantages against Cleveland than Cleveland will be able to create in their favor. All right, so who did you have number seven on this list of teams who are most confident? Who do you hate the second most?
Well, so this is one of those, it's an honor just to be nominated to this, I guess. But so the middle of this kind of this eight pack of teams is like it's all really, you know, seasoned to taste. It's so much like that's hemming and hawing. It's the Bulls.
Me too.
I feel guilty about it because I they've been one of the like Cleveland, one of the best sort of surprises of the season. The degree to which the DeRozan sign and trade has not just worked, but like been a revelation, his ability to not come in and like, there's been no jostling for primacy with him and LaVine. He's just, they fit together. Like LaVine's, effectiveness and efficiency and the volume's down a little bit, but everything else is like all-star level the way it was last year. But then you also add in a 28-5-5 guy who's shooting whatever 50-something% from the floor. It's been remarkable how well he's fit offensively, DeRozan, into that mix. It's the inverse problem of what we talked about with Cleveland. That defense was great at the start of the season with Lonzo Ball and Alex Caruso up top, wreaking havoc, getting into passing lanes, forcing turnovers, getting the transition game going. And we've seen, I think, when those guys have not been available, the Bulls have looked like the defense a lot of us worried they might be heading into the season. I believe from cleaning the glass, I just looked this up a little while ago, they've given up 117.5 points per 100 possessions with Ball and Caruso off the court. The Rockets have the worst defense in the league this season at 117.6. So it's not exactly in line, but if you don't have that ball pressure up top, the ability to get around screens, keep teams from getting into the teeth of the defense, engaging Nick Vucevic on the pick and roll, like making him step up, you don't have a whole lot of rim protection there. They were hoping that sort of like the weak side power forwards, whether it was Patrick Williams at the beginning of the season or Javonte Green or whoever they were going to be able to put there, would be able to provide some of that like activity and secondary rim protection, but that's kind of Pat Williams has been hurt for most of the season. Javonte Green's been better than I think you could have hoped for, but also in and out. They just haven't really been an imposing paint protecting, rim protecting team. So you've got to get those stops up top. And if you don't have your two best guys to do that, you're going to struggle. Now, obviously, the glass half full take on that is like, well, those guys are coming back at some point. It's just, when are they coming back? Are they going to be fully sort of engaged in rhythm as when they get into the postseason? And like, have you kind of already overtaxed what you'd be asking for from DeRozan and LaVine enough where like needing them to be Superman pretty much every night to make up for a defense that can't quite cover it's a tough ask when you're going against some of the like more complete teams that you'll see elsewhere in the East.
I agree 100%. That's the bulk of my concern is how will those guys be? If I were guaranteed that Caruso and Lonzo Ball would be coming back 100%, I'd have them higher on this list. I'd feel better about them, but it's going to be cutting it so close, and they are so, so essential. I love how the Bulls have compensated for those defensive weaknesses. In the NBA today, it shouldn't just be, oh, you have Alex Caruso and Lonzo Ball at guard, and that's making the difference defensively. Right. But again, my classic insult, they compete really hard in the regular season. And, you know, in the playoffs, not everybody does. But, this team is working to overcome its defensive deficiencies. I'd say they're even overachieving without those two. I thought it'd fall off by even more because those two have been so essential. So it looked better in every way. I don't think, like, Nikola Vucevic is this great rim-protecting center. He's not this great space center. He's not, like, who you'd want defensively at center. But I don't think he's going to just be played off the floor because he competes so hard. And then by going smaller, which they love to do, I think really fits well into a playoff defense. But the key is you got to have those guys back 100% to overachieve where you have them on this list. And the power forward position is interesting because there's talk now Patrick Williams could be back for the playoffs. I'm not totally sure whether that's a good or bad thing for this season. He's so raw. He's so young. Having missed all this time, you try and push him back in, even if everything is set around him. That could be an exploitable spot, but the bar is not high. That has been a problem spot. It's been like the Spinal Tap drummer, where it's just one guy after another. But maybe you get healthier at the right time; they're clicking. I think Billy Donovan's done a good job with this team. One player I really wonder about is DeMar DeRozan. I mean, he has been awesome. He's been really good before, and has a really ugly playoff history with the Raptors. And, okay, has he taken the next step where his game is more foolproof for the playoffs? He's not quite so much relying now on some of the pump fakes to get free throws that fell apart in the playoffs once teams had him in the scouting report and saw him a few days in a row. Not that that's not part of his game, but it's not as essential to his game. He's making everything from mid-range. Is that going to to change? Is he just like on a hot streak to a degree? Is this sustainable? And if it is sustainable, just in general, does it translate better to the playoffs? I mean, on paper, in a lot of ways, he looks like somebody who should be excellent for the playoffs, who can create his own shot against a tough defense. That's exactly what you want in a lead player, and Zach LaVine can do it too. I have a little more trust in LaVine because I haven't seen it. I'm afraid with DeRozan because I have seen it.
I hear what you're saying. And weirdly, I wonder if, you know, this is a styles make fights kind of question, but one of the things that I kind of jotted down and thinking about it was their offensive personnel, like they're set up to really destroy a drop coverage opponent, right? If they draw somebody who's playing a lot of drop, because DeMar can just walk into those pull-ups, LaVine can, you know, pull around a screen from three, Vucevic being a pick and pop big, they've got personnel to really kind of bust up that coverage. But then you look at where some of the opponents they might face, like Miami switches a ton. The Bucks have been switching more, and we don't know what they're gonna look like with Brook Lopez back or not back. You know, the Cavs play more of a pure drop, but they're also more mobile with their bigs. The Celtics switch a ton. The Raptors switch a ton. The Nets have been a switching defense, although we'll see how much of that was Harden and how, you know, what if Ben Simmons is actually available. You know, if he's in the mix. All these, there's a lot of teams that are more, and obviously the Heat, you know, I forget if I mentioned the Heat, but they switch like more than almost anybody in the league besides the Celtics. So like the idea that you might walk into a situation where your best kind of counterpunch to a playoff defense might not be as easy to get to because they might be able to do something like, I don't know, like stick, you know, a smaller guy on you to start and then you try to run pick, or stick a small guy on your center, you try to run pick and roll and then all of a sudden, bam, Adebayo's all over you. Or whatever, something like that. You try to go run pick and roll, and all of a sudden you're getting Robert Williams switched on to you, and that it's a little bit harder for you to get to those shot creation opportunities. But yeah, I mean, I think I'm a little bit more optimistic about DeRozan's ability to maintain his level. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to shoot like 60% from two over a postseason again. You know, it's like it's not. He's been so incredible with the pull ups and the crazy like contested shots he's making from all over the court. But I think I'm a little less, if it falls off, I think it's just going to be because those kind of shots are just really hard to live by. And not because like he has some sort of indefinable failing that is going to like fall short in the playoffs. I think the kind of skill and temperament advancements that he's made over the last several years, where he's rounded out his game, he's become a better facilitator. He's a sort of embraced who he is more than trying to paper over who he's not. I kind of feel like is the way that DeRozan's last couple of years have gone. So you know, the shots will go in or they won't, but I would still feel pretty confident with the ball in his hands, although evidently not confident enough to put them higher than seventh on my list.
Yes. We'll say it probably several more times. These are all teams we like. These are, you know, this is a good group of teams. We're ranking teams within a good tier. All right. My number six is the Dallas Mavericks.
And okay.
We're starting to get a little higher, you know, maybe up a tier. It's harder to poke holes. You know, I like how they've defended this year. I think Jason Kidd has done an excellent job of getting everybody on the same page. The classic insult, they compete hard, but also it's smart, you know, and they have good versatility with it, maybe even better versatility than you would think with some of their pieces. I mean, Dorian Finney-Smith is the exact type of style of defender you want in the playoffs, can guard multiple positions, can defend different ways. Luka Doncic has the size. You know, Reggie Bullock has a little bit of versatility on the wing. Maxi Kleba, a versatile defender. Dwight Powell, they're starting to say, a versatile defender. So I like a lot of how those things will translate. The offense hasn't quite been there. I don't trust Jason Kidd as a playoff coach, but as Luka Doncic has gotten in shape, he has been incredible. He could overcome, like, our offense isn't well-designed to get great shots. Well, when Luka Doncic is playing like this, what isn't a great shot with him in total charge? And Jalen Brunson really puts Doncic in a better position to succeed by being able to play off the ball and spot up around Doncic, by being able to play on the ball and let Luka work off the ball. I love how they interact with each other. And so, yeah, this team has a lot of ingredients. I'm not sure it has the overall talent level you'd want to see around a star like Luka Doncic, which is why they're, you know, on the lower part of this list, but I like how they play.
Yeah, no, that's a completely reasonable pick. I actually had them a little bit higher because just for the only reason that I had this other team in my sixth spot is I had Denver in sixth.
Okay, so I have Denver fifth. So we're
okay. So we're in the same ballpark here. All right. So and the main reason is I think they occupy similar spaces where it's like I completely believe in their number one guy being somebody that can win a series or can at least push a team to the limit by himself. I believe in their ability to construct. I mean, they don't have an ideal infrastructure around them, but like construct an ecosystem where they can win even against tough opponents. With the Nuggets, I think so much of their the degree to which you believe in them, I think depends on who they're going to have available. And, you know, where there's reports this week that Michael Porter Jr. might not be far away, that Jamal Murray might be relatively close in coming back. And obviously, if they have those guys at, 100% capacity or close to it and able to integrate them into their rotation, they vault very high up this list. They go from like a, maybe they could win a series team to a maybe they could make the conference finals again team. But that's asking so much after Murray's missed a year plus, and it's asking a lot of Michael Porter Jr. after, going back surgery and having been laid off for so long and never actually really getting out of the blocks this season and what I think everybody expected to be a really big year for him. So, Jokic has been obviously incredible. The work that Michael Malone has done in getting that second unit to play up, where they introduce Bryn Forbes at the deadline, they add some more shooting and some more movement. They bring in DeMarcus Cousins to kind of solidify the backup 5 minutes. That what was a real weakness for them in the second unit has become a more stable sort of concern that they don't have to worry quite so much about when Jokic goes off the floor. But as you mentioned earlier, your rotation is going to winnow down. So I don't necessarily know that they're going to like win and lose games based on the Bryn Forbes and DeMarcus Cousins minutes. Maybe they will. Maybe they won't. I don't know. But I think if you could tell me with certainty that we were going to see like pretty much full strength Michael Porter Jr. and full strength Jamal Murray, then I might bump them, the Mavs down a little further here too. But I think the Mavs team that we've seen for the last couple of months, I think is the one that we're going to see in the playoffs, and the Nuggets team. I just don't know. That uncertainty led me to drop them down a little bit. But I'd love to be wrong, because it would be freaking awesome to see those guys actually get back into it and be like in rhythm and healthy, and say like, all right, who wants to play us in the first round? I don't think there would be a whole lot of takers for it.
Yeah, so the Mavericks are mostly going to be the team we've seen. The big additions being Spencer Dinwiddie and Davis Bertans. I don't even know if we can call Kristaps Porzingis a subtraction.
Sure.
With all the absences he already had. But he was playing at a good level when he played. What do you make of Dinwiddie and Bertans' fit? Obviously, we're with a small sample so far. I think they've both played well. I don't think Bertans has missed a two-pointer or had a turnover yet. He's just taking threes and not making them as much as it seems like he should yet. But you think that will come? I like him in a simplified role. Dinwiddie, I'm having a little bit of a tougher time seeing how it's going to work over the long term. Not in a bad way. Not like, oh, it's not going to work. My question is like, how well is it going to work? He's fitting in. He's helping to move the ball. He has the size, another versatile defender. He can play on off the ball. I'm not sure his shooting is ideal to be in some of these lineups. What do you make of those additions? Or are they too minor for you to move the needle a ton on Dallas?
No, I mean, I think you're right to point to it. But Bertans is like, it's almost like you're just, he's out there to, for the purpose of needing someone to stand near him. Like that's kind of all they're really asking him to do. He was only shooting about like 34% from three. He's taken a ton in really short minutes. I think it's like more than six a game and 16 minutes a night. So like the ball gets to him and it's going up, but he's like a mile marker. Hey, you have to be over here. Dinwiddie is kind of the swing piece of it. And you're right. Like, it's been basically all you could ask for out of him: 14 a game, 4 assists, a couple of rebounds. Fitting in with and without, or both alongside and in place of Luka. The issue to me though is like, we talk about honeymoon periods of after deals, and like guys are on their best behavior, or they get a bump from a new being in a breath of fresh air in a new setting. Like Spencer Dinwiddie's shooting 60% from the floor in Dallas. I don't think that's going to keep happening. There's nothing in his past to suggest that a 45% three-point shooter is something that we're going to be able to bank on him being. And so like, I think a lot of this is, we talked at times about shooting luck on the defensive end, like, well, that team's been, shooting up the defensive rankings, but it's because opponents have been missing a lot of threes. Or I wonder if, when Spencer Dinwiddie's not at like 60-40, is that going to, how much is that going to impede his effectiveness? But another ball handler. Like they needed that even with Brunson. You know, they needed somebody else to absorb some of those possessions. So it wasn't like Luka had to have a 45 usage rate for them to even be in the conversation. If Dinwiddie is able to, you know, at least just shoulder some of that, add some more size in the backcourt, as you said, and like another playmaker, somebody that you at least have to respect and honor as a playmaker that can get Luka off the ball a little bit more or just get him a breather a little bit more, that helps their ceiling. I kind of need to see Dinwiddie do that against a good defense for 2 weeks to believe it, because his best years were in Brooklyn when he had the ball in his hands because Kyrie Irving wasn't there at all. And even in those contexts, he was shooting like 40% from the floor and 30% from three. He was just with a lot of volume and passing the ball well. So to pick and choose like a la carte menu, maybe you can take the best of some of his pick and roll play and this sort of newfound increase in shooting efficiency, and he can marry those together and become, if he does that, he's a phenomenal, you know, sixth or seventh man for them. But it's, I kind of need to see it to believe it.
Yeah, I'm with you. The Nuggets, you know, obviously I'm a huge believer in Jokic too. I feel like it's been, I don't know, 3-4 years running now where it's like, well, at some point somebody's going to, you know, not play him off the floor defensively, but really take advantage of his limitations. I haven't seen that in the playoffs. It's not like he's a great defender, but I haven't really even seen him exploit it that much. That includes a year where he got Denver all the way to the conference finals. So I'm starting to think like, oh, he's just going to translate. We know his offense will. He can do everything. He can score from anywhere in every different way. His passing, like, you know, you slow the game down, whatever. He is still going to find ways to create elite offense. If I knew, you know, you mentioned, you know, you knew if you could know that Jamal Murray and Michael Porter Jr. were coming back and fully healthy, I might have them number one on this list, two at the lowest. Like, this is, I love them as a championship contender on paper, but it is on paper. I'm with you. It's a tough ask. I got to assume Michael Porter Jr., when he was playing earlier in the year, it was because of these back issues.
Sure.
But it's not 100% that's what it was. I mean, he was still playing, but he was not good. So there's some concern there, right? What else is going on? Even if he could come back 100%, I got some doubts he's coming back 100%. An NBA doctor, for them to get the disabled player exception, had to rule it was substantially more likely than not he'd be out through June 15th, and they got it. So now it's like, oh, he could come back by the end of the month. And look, he's allowed to come back. He can beat that projection. The doctor could be wrong. But I wonder, like, is he rushing back? Is he actually going to come back? It's one thing to talk about. Are we actually going to see him on the court? And if we see him on the court, are we actually going to see him at a high level? I got some big concerns there. And Jamal Murray coming back. Like, there's no guarantees he can just hit the ground running. But this team badly needs a couple extra pieces. I think what they're doing with Bryn Forbes, what they're doing with DeMarcus Cousins, I think that could be pivotal. I've seen enough playoff games where the 76ers were like plus 45 with Joel Embiid, and they get outscored by 50 in the 12 minutes he sits, and now you lose. And I mean, the Nuggets look like that type of team earlier in the season. One of my biggest disappointments with Denver is that I thought they'd be better with Jeff Green at center. I thought that would unlock a different element for them that they could use at times when Jokic sits. And, you know, maybe they'll be that right matchup in the playoffs. But that's one of the reasons why they've been so dreadful when Jokic sits, is that didn't really work. This team isn't quite as versatile as I would like, but that's at the strength they're at. You get more versatile if you have Jamal Murray, if you have Michael Porter Jr.
Right. Yeah, you put in a couple of like all-star caliber guys, and all of a sudden everything looks a lot rosier for sure.
But on the other hand, like some of the things those guys would add, the offense, like that's been good for Denver. They've had those role players step up. So the level you're replacing with Porter Jr. and Murray, it's not the most crucial, but yes, it would help. All right,
just one last note on that. So I was looking at
Nugget.
Well, there it is. I was looking at the 538 projections, and they've got, you know, you were talking earlier about teams that, you know, what they look like in the regular season, then when their rotation winnows down. 538 casts that as full strength rating. And, you know, if everybody's healthy and everybody's playing a full complement of minutes, and based on that, they project the Nuggets as the best team in the West. They project the Nuggets, the only team that has a higher full strength rating in a playoff setting than the Nuggets would be the Celtics, which, you know, we could talk about, you know, we'll talk about them eventually. But like the idea that the Nuggets as fully constituted with everybody playing what you would project a starter's, a healthy starter's minutes to be, is like a, you know, potential sleeping giant there. Just, you know, it remains to be seen whether we actually see it.
Yes. And so that incorporates Porter Jr., or I guess it incorporates Porter Jr., incorporates Murray, because some of those rankings, you know, if he hasn't played this season, I got to imagine he's showing up there if they're so high.
I would imagine. I mean, otherwise it's like we're really into Facundo Campazzo here. So that might be it's reading that bias.
All right. So now we're to the top half. Teams we hate a little less than those teams in the bottom half. Who is your number four team?
Well, I actually had Dallas at four, so I'll go. So we'll just go with the next.
Oh, yeah, Dallas at four. Okay.
Because just on the strength of, I think at some point Luka is just going to win them a series by himself, basically. And I think that I would believe that more this year, based on the way he's been the last couple of months and the fact that they now, you know, the way they've been playing defensively the last couple of months, I think they're a better bet for that. But the next team on my list that I had was is Utah. And they are like a really tough team to read. You know, they go through 8 of 9 where they are losing 7 of 8 or 8 of 9 when you are without Mitchell and Gobert for long stretches of that. Then they get him back and they win 8 of 9. They go in and they beat Phoenix for the first time in God knows how long. You know, a really nice weekend of sort of, you know, clutch wins against good teams. Now they're, you know, they're hoping with an outside shot of, you know, moving up in the top half of the West if Golden State continues to slide. And with them, it always, you know, we've talked about this a lot. It comes back to that offense is going to score. It used to be that Utah, you couldn't rely on them making open shots in the playoffs. You would rely on the defense, but not on them making open shots. They reorganized sort of the chemistry of the team, the balance of it, tilted it towards shot creation, ball movement, and guys who can create. And now it's, can they stop anybody on the perimeter? I was talking a little bit to Tony Jones, The Athletic, about it recently and said, like, is it overly simplistic to say that how well Donovan Mitchell and Mike Conley can defend at the point of attack is what basically determines the ceiling of this team? Like, if you have everybody's healthy, everybody's available, and, you know, I just saw today they're going to start looking to ramp up Conley's minutes a little bit. He might start playing more in back-to-backs, you know, get him kind of ramped up for the postseason. You know, is that really what the difference is going to be? Because if they can't stop anybody at the point of the attack, then you're going to get dribble penetration. You're going to have Rudy Gobert rotating over. You're going to leave Terrence Mann open in the corner. And we've seen that movie before. You know, we know how that works. So it's just, can you stop ball? And they've been better with that, you know, since, you know, Daniel House has been a nice addition for them. But I mean, you know, Trent Forrest is a guy who's been a useful player for them in the second unit. I don't know. Again, those guys can be like important players for stretches. I think if you're relying on them to be the people who swing your season, then you're probably in a dicier spot than you'd like to be. But I think that's really the key issue for them. I don't think, as you said with Jokic, I think the degree to which we talk about Rudy Gobert getting played off the floor has been, you know, erroneous to some degree, unfair. Like, the dude can move out there. He's been on the business end of some bad highlights over the years, but he's a lot better as a switch and isolation defender than people realize. And they have not lost because Rudy Gobert is a stiff. They've lost because they couldn't stop anybody at the point of attack. And then on the other end, maybe they couldn't punish mismatches quite the way they hoped for. So much of it comes back to me to stop and dribble penetration, and are those guys equipped to do it? And I think it's going to depend on who they're guarding, so who they draw in those matchups. Like, if you wind up in a 4-5 with Dallas, and you got to deal with Luka, I think that's an awfully tough beat for them. But then, you know, if you're getting sort of A-plus effort on the ball from Mitchell, if you're getting A-plus effort on the ball from Conley, and those guys are healthy enough to move, I think that changes everything for Utah.
I have the Jazz number one on this list.
Whoa!
Yeah, so our first big disagreement. I believe in them.
I was going to say, sell me, make the case for why you buy him.
You've nailed the issue. It's not Rudy Gobert, but it's also a structure where you are depending on Rudy Gobert. You're asking for these problems, and so to a degree that is Rudy Gobert, because he's not the guy who's going to get out to Terrence Mann in the corner. That's, you know, so you're leaving yourself vulnerable there. The vulnerability is exposed because of Conley and Mitchell's defense. I guess I'm starting off with what concerns me. I am afraid of this, but this is, I think, just the best team on the list. That's it. I do have the concerns about how they translate, but their offense is incredible. Donovan Mitchell's playing at such a high level, and then when you have Bogdan Bogdanovic playing with him, Bojan Bogdanovic playing with him, when you have Mike Conley playing with him. Rudy Gobert is an underrated offensive player. I think they're going to score a lot. And then I think they have the capability defensively. I don't think Mike Conley and Donovan Mitchell should be as bad defensively as they are. I think they have the tools. I think they can be better. And I think these are the type of lessons that you learn through losing in the playoffs, which they've done and done. So this is the year to come out and show that you have the defensive intensity, the attention to detail. Donovan Mitchell has enough offensive help where I don't think it's a valid excuse of, oh, he's got to carry this whole load. Maybe he'll make it his excuse. Maybe that'll be the problem. But it shouldn't be. It shouldn't have to be. I just think this team has the right depth, the right talent. They fit together. They've got great chemistry. I love how they move the ball. And it can work with Rudy Gobert. Maybe you just hit the right matchups a little bit, too. Maybe you don't have to worry about this. He cleans up so much. They've been excellent when he's been on the court. Their problems have come when he's sat. And that's been against a lot of different types of teams. And to his credit, he's also become more versatile. He's better at handling when he gets dragged out on the floor, if that's going to happen, because of how the opposing offense is going to play. Right? Teams aren't picking on him. So I have all the same concerns you do stylistically. I just see a team that's playing at such a high level. I don't think they're a paper tiger.
No, I think that's fair. And I think, this gets back to maybe the, like you said, the issue with the list. It's like, we are talking about a class of teams that we all agree are very good. They're just going to have to play other really good teams that might have fewer flaws that are exploitable in order to advance. And so that's like me saying that I think the Jazz are in kind of the middle of this pack is not like I expect them to get swept in the first round and we should all boo them when they do it. It's more like they're going to have to at some point play an opponent in all likelihood. We'll see how the bracket breaks down, but where like you are going to have two really tough perimeter players to guard and you have one Royce O'Neal and one Daniel House. And you need Donovan Mitchell and Mike Conley, to answer that call. And even if they, by the way, also even if those guys do it, like if you are dealing with, multiple bigger wings, then that's a tough ask too, because Royce O'Neal's only so big, and Mitchell and Conley are not large guards either. They have better length for their positions, but still. So I think that structural issue of, you just don't have maybe quite enough size and quite enough elite defensive players on the wing. Maybe that won't come back to bite him based on the matchups. Maybe better health and better activity from their starters on the defensive end solve that problem. It's certainly possible. I believe they can score with whoever they're going to deal with. I'm not sure I believe they're going to get enough stops, and I think that's going to be a problem.
It might be. I mean, it very well might be. Joe Ingles has been a good part of their offense. He had lost such a step defensively that I feel like they're avoiding an issue there, not having to play him with him getting injured. Like, I think he's starting to get to the point where he was a good defender in his prime, but as he's aged, he's been somebody who's really just gotten roasted on that end. And so you lose that, you place him with someone like Daniel House in the rotation, who is a good defender. Right. Is he a good enough player overall that you're going to want to get him a lot of minutes? No, not ideally. I think that is one of the issues where, okay, well, you got your Royce O'Neals, you got your Daniel Houses, and those guys can be okay offensively and solid defensively. But then if you want better offense, you're going to have somebody like Jordan Clarkson in, who is not at all a good defender. So when you have to make those choices, I'm listing more negatives than positives because I think the positives are just simple. This is a really good team. They've got good players. I'm not overthinking it there on this list, right? My question at the end was going to be, do I think any of these teams belong in the top five? Do they belong ahead of these teams that everybody else considers the top championship contenders? My answer is no, while we're talking about the Jazz. They're my top team. I have them a tier below because of these questions, right? Sure. I think in the regular season, they're better than at least a couple of and maybe even most of those top five teams. But when you get in the playoffs, it's questionable. And part of me is hoping that they understand this, right? There's nothing the Jazz can prove in this regular season. And so they don't look like a team that's coasting to me, but also they're a team that has every reason to coast. So there's some hope there of, do they have another gear? Do they have tricks up their sleeves? Do they have things they haven't shown where they can up it even a level? Because they're not a team that looks like they should be prioritizing this regular season.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So then who was your four?
So my four was the Memphis Grizzlies.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
I have them at two. I have them a little higher.
At two. Okay. I want to believe more in the Memphis Grizzlies. I love how they play. I love their activity level. I love their energy, their passion. It goes back to inexperience. I think that matters in the playoffs when we've been through this, where you've seen how it works as you go through a series and adjusting to matchups. I think they're going to run into some things there. But I think we talk about play hard. This is a play hard team. But the way they have the athleticism, especially through Ja Morant, but their athleticism and their depth, which allows them to play harder, right? It's not just, oh, we're going to play hard while we're out there. It's, we're going to have really talented and really athletic players playing hard because they can go hard and know they can catch a breather because the backups are pretty good too. So I think a lot of that translates. Why are you even higher on them than me?
Well, so this is sort of a simplistic analysis. I'll grant that. But I think one reason is, you look at their sort of season breakdown. Ja Morant averages 33 minutes a game. Desmond Bane plays 30. They haven't had Dylan Brooks for most of the season. When he plays, he's played 28. Jaren Jackson, 28. Their best players don't play all that much. And it's sort of a carryover from something that Taylor Jenkins took from Mike Budenholzer with, like, you're depressing the minute loads in part because you want to take advantage of your depth and in part to keep guys fresher. Like, if you're telling me that I'm going to maybe in the course of a playoff series get 40 minutes out of Ja, 38 minutes out of Desmond Bane, you know, that you're going to be able to keep those guys on the floor for longer, it raises the ceiling for what they can be. The Grizzlies have been able to, as you mentioned, they've been able to persevere throughout injuries to different guys, including that great stretch at the beginning of the season that kind of got them going, where they think they won like 10 out of 12 without Ja. But they're kind of operating at a 55 win pace without overtaxing anyone. And so I think that there's a chance that when they push push the pedal down and really hit the gas, I think there's a chance they could even go up a notch. And so that's part of it. I think part of it is also their defense. You mentioned the sort of the effort and the energy of it. It's just also really good. They against top 10 opponents, so teams that are top 10 in net rating. This is also from Cleaning the Glass. They've been sixth in the league in defense. They 110 points per 100 possessions. They've been really, their offense has struggled a little bit. They've been more of an average offense, and that's something we can talk about as a concern for them. Where some of their the things that they rely on can dry up a little bit in the postseason. But I think their defense is going to give them a chance. I think that obviously foul trouble is going to be an issue because Jaren Jackson Jr. has been so important for them, and he's had a propensity to foul. But that has come down this season. That's one of the big reasons he's made such a leap, is that he's not constantly in foul trouble. I believe, and I mean, I think if you're asking me, like, who's going to be the best player in this seven-game series, in years past, you would have said, like, Ja's not quite. I think Ja can be the best player against pretty much every team in the West in a seven-game series. And they've had matchups will matter. They've had a really tough time with Dallas this season. Luka is a big problem for them because they don't have that real great 3-and-D wing that's like a big 3-and-D wing. They're trying different guys on him, but they're usually smaller and not quite as physical. But I think that I think there's a really good chance they get to second. I think there seems to be no real answer for when Draymond Green's going to come back. They're only a half game behind the Warriors now. The Warriors are about to go on a big road trip. Memphis is like has a solid schedule ahead of them, and they've been playing really well. I think if you're in second, then you're getting, the first play-in team as opposed to having to deal with, like, Jokic in round one. That's a big differentiator. I don't know. Yeah, this might be, like, the optimism of just really enjoying watching them coloring my analysis here. But I think that there's a chance that, like, they've had a wonderful season, but we've still kind of have a lot left in the tank to see from them.
That's interesting. I think we're kind of coming at it from opposite ends. You're like, oh, they can increase the minutes of these players. To me, that's one of their strengths, is that they don't have to, and that allows those guys to play so hard when they're on the court. And I should just say, when I talk about the effort they play with and the athleticism, there's also a physicality with it. This is a tough physical team. I can see them wearing down a team over a playoff series. And to do that, I don't think you want to get the minutes too high, but you're right, it could go up a little. And, having Ja Morant more on the floor would solve some of their offensive issues. He is incredible. I don't know. It's a young team, and you don't see a young team like this usually advance too far. But they've been ahead of schedule every single year.
It's a young team that's also won elimination games, though. Like, I mean, now you can say the play-in's not the playoffs, and that's totally fair. But, like, this is not – they were a 30-win team to they're a 55-win team. It's like they've done the couple of years of climbing the ladder and then going in and being in the play-in series, then winning the play-in series and going and winning a playoff game. Like, they've taken some of those lumps. And this core, these young guys, most of them have been together to do it. So I think that's, like – they're not going to be surprised by what the leap in level of intensity is going to be. And they're going to be hosting playoff games for the first time. I don't know. I think that there's a recipe here for a deep run for them. The nature of the top of the West and of the talent in this middle class is such that any outcome from first round out to finals would not surprise me for Memphis. I think they have probably the widest spread of any team on the board.
I could agree with that. And I think that fits almost every team on this board, though. I think of the potential. But, yeah, you want to say Memphis especially. I agree. In a lot of ways, they remind me of that Thunder team, 2011, when the year before was the first time that young group had made the playoffs. They made the first round. The next year, they made the conference finals. Like, right, they were ready for it. This is a smart team, too. A lot of smart players who have great chemistry together because they have been through it. They're not going to be phased by the intensity of playoffs. I don't mean that. I don't mean scared of the moment. This team is far, far, far from that. What concerns me a little bit is the adjustments you go as you see the same team over and over, right? Desmond Bain has really expanded his game. He's still learning how to be that player who has the ball in his hands. How many moves does he have? If the defense has seen his first move, has seen his counter, like, does he have another counter in his bag there? Whereas you're seeing the same team over and over, how is that going to go? I don't know, right? It could go well. Like, they might be ready for this. It's just those small doubts where I have them just a little bit lower on the list.
Well, I hate you, and Memphis is mad at you. So let's just go there, and then we'll move on to number three. I had the Boston Celtics at number three. My colleague Zach Cram at The Ringer just wrote about them. You mentioned earlier our Ringer odds machine. That's Zach's baby. And he noted that in his numbers and then also the numbers at 538 and Basketball Reference and so on and so forth, they love the Celtics team. And a lot of that's based on point differential, that when they've won, they've blown teams out. They've had a crazy defensive rating for the last couple of months. They have sort of built up the kinds of things that a lot of the metrics or the projection models really love. I believe in the defense. I don't think there's any sort of smoke and mirrors with that. And I think that they're already kind of playing a tight rotation, 7-8 guys. Now, whether that might come back to bite them, I don't know. To me, it's just fairly simplistic. Like, they have everybody in their main group is a pretty good passer. They don't have a real, like, this guy unlocks your defense kind of level passer between Smart and Derek White, who's been good for them since they just got him. Tatum as his ceiling is like top 10 scoring threat, but not quite the same like wing initiator in the same way. Jaylen Brown, like a tick below that. Horford and Robert Williams are good passers for bigs, and you can run offense through them. But I worry, you get a slowdown series, you're in the half court. Are you going to be able to generate enough clean looks that are not like Tatum dribbling out the clock, sidestep 20-footer? Our friend Mike Pina at Sports Illustrated recently wrote about Tatum's shifting his shot selection, which he's done before over the course of a season. Like, as the season goes on, it's more rim and threes than it is mid-range. And so maybe that solves a lot of the problems. If you're getting more rim pressure, you're getting more free throws, you're getting better possessions generally. And if some of those 20-footers are 24-footers and you're making them, you get the extra point. So, welcome to my Sloan Conference talk. But I think that it's the question of, are they going to get seized up in a playoff series and against another really good defense? And I'm maybe a little more bearish on their ability to wring out like maximum offensive effectiveness from the group they've got than I am about the final East team, spoiler alert, that I have not spoken about yet.
I also have the Celtics third. I love their defense. See, I do think there's a little element of smoke and mirrors to it. Where they're putting Robert Williams on a wing, I think it really screws up opponents. And I don't think that's going to be the easiest thing to counter. I say that because I don't have a great counter, but I can see it's happening. And I have some trust that an NBA coach can figure some things out, where I think it's taking teams by surprise a little bit more. It's just so unusual, right? And it works so well. He's capable of that. Robert Williams can get out of the perimeter. He can get back in the paint. And a lot of this is unlocked by Al Horford, you know, being that big in the paint. So you're playing this two big lineup that's working really well. And they're using it, doing it defensively in a real creative way. And they even do it without Al Horford on the court. I don't think you can do that against every lineup, but you can do it against plenty when you're going smaller. So you put Robert Williams out on the wing, and then he's rotating in and out to the paint as things go. I feel like there's some counters there. I just feel like teams are taken aback by that a little bit right now. And when you play them in a playoff series, maybe figure some out.
Well, I think, and a lot of it too, you know, now Horford obviously does change matters, but we had a similar, it wasn't exactly the same alignment, but I remember writing something in the bubble a couple of years, I was not in the bubble, but during the bubble playoffs a couple of years ago, where like Jaylen Brown's ability to guard fives kind of helped them mix, you know, like muck up opposing offenses. And then they ran into Miami in the second round and Bam went for like 22, 11 and 5 on 60% shooting in that series and like put them away. And it's like, well, yeah, if you're like junking up the matchups to put a wing on a big, when the big can do something with that, whether it's Bam or Embiid or, you know, it's Giannis or whoever, like you got to play some of those things more straight. And they're probably going to have to face at least one of the, you know, not to give Ime Udoka and his staff short shrift. I'm sure they would have some plan Bs for that as well to play a little more straight. And, you know, to rely more on the wings that they've got, where you've got guys that can sort of plug a bunch of different gaps. But yeah, I think those plans in the course of a series, I think you can game plan against that a little bit, particularly when you've got the kind of talented bigs that they might have to go through to get where they want to go.
The benefit for Boston's defense is this defensive personnel is awesome, right? Play whatever scheme you want. There's a lot of options here. These are excellent defenders throughout. Derek White fits right in. I think Derek White fits offensively really well, too, as a ball mover. Someone's going to make quick decisions, can shoot a little bit from the perimeter. I haven't seen him taking on the passing responsibilities offense that I think he could. Maybe that's because he's still working his way in. But I think there's a higher ceiling there. This offense could be good in the playoffs. Not great. But it could be good. It also could be really, really bad. They're relying on a lot of streaky three-point shooters. Is Derek White going to make his threes? Is Al Horford going to make his threes? Is Grant Williams going to make his threes? Is Marcus Smart going to make his threes? Right. Those are, you know, the secondary guys. I mean, Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum can run hot and cold. Although I think we've seen from Tatum, you know, he has stepped up a lot in the playoffs. I've got confidence in him. But I'm also wondering, like, why is he not shooting better this season? It's, you know, an interesting point he mentioned about Pina making, about, you know, shifting his shot profile. But also, even with the shots he's taking, I feel like he should be shooting better this season. Is there something going on there that's going to continue in playoffs, or is it something that, you know, will change? You know, it's really interesting. You mentioned it, how these projection models have the Celtics so high. I'm not nearly that high on him, but I like them a lot. I also have them third. Should we just stop right here? You know, we've listed seven teams, and I feel like maybe we should just direct everybody to read your article on the team you have number one, the team I have number two. You know what? Why should they get any of this content for free listening to this? They should go give the Ringer some hits and read it. Stop right now?
I think they can do both.
Okay, that's very nice of you.
Drum roll, please. Yeah, my number one team is the Miami Heat. And I, as you mentioned, I just wrote about them last week, and they did me the service of not getting like blown out right after. They're the Ringer first, did not jump up and bite them, which I appreciate. I think the conceit of the article was sort of, are they a sleeping giant? Now, of course, Heat fans who are very aware of national outlets not speaking about the Miami Heat were like, the only one asleep is you, bro. We know how good they are. And I was like, that's not what we meant. The idea
Jesus, the way to turn anything into an insult.
Well, I mean, such is life, you know, writing on the internet.
I'll be honest, I'm impressed that they could twist it that way. I'm impressed. This is not an insult to Heat fans. I am impressed.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like players are constantly in search of the chip on the shoulder motivator. Like fan bases are too, for sure. And they don't get to get out their aggression on the court. So, but it was the idea was we like the Heat are already this good. They're 41-21, two games up in the East. You know, I haven't looked at it right now, but it was something like seventh in offense, fifth in defense, like really, really good. And they've barely had their full team together. You know, like only 20 some, you know, like low 20s of games where you've had Bam and Jimmy and Kyle Lowry on the court together, factor in Tyler Hero, and it gets down to like 14 or 15. The minute numbers for those groups are really low. And honestly, like, the, you know, the projection or the production for those groups has not been ideal either. Like, when you have those four guys, Bam, Jimmy, Hero, and Lowry on the court, I believe they've been outscored on the season. And it's a small sample, but hasn't been kind of what you would expect from that collection of talent. And even so, they have been that good. And so the question that I had and I kind of tried to look into was, well, A, how have they gotten to this point despite being without so many of their key guys for extended stretches and sometimes multiple of those guys at, you know, at one time? And then the secondary point is, has Eric Spoelstra and have that staff, have that team, have they developed things through that those absences and through the way they've had to adjust their schematic approach or their rotations, et cetera? Have they found different ways to be really good that could then also serve them as they get their full complement of guys back? And I think the answer to that is yeah. I think that, I mean, obviously we know Eric Spoelstra is the, you know, one of the most innovative and sort of malleable coaches in the league. He's, you know, he's not really dogmatic in terms of what he's looking for in any one particular area. Like, he will take whatever talent is on board and fit a scheme to it to be able to get the most out of it, put guys in positions to succeed that otherwise, you know, might have been fringe players in the league. And then all of a sudden Duncan Robinson's making $80 million, you know, things like that. So, but I think what they've found is, like, now it's not just Bam has to run the dribble handoff with Duncan Robinson. It's okay, PJ Tucker can do that, and he can do it with Max Strus, and he can do it with Tyler Hero, and he can do, you know, like, there's a lot of options for the ways they can attack differently. They haven't gotten to run a ton of their different pick and roll combinations, but they've got like five or six guys who can handle on either end of the pick and roll. If Duncan Robinson's setting a screen, you got to be really worried he's going to pop out and hit a three. Tyler Hero, you got to be really worried he's either going to hit a three on the catch or drive and, you know, against a bent defense and be able to get all the way to the rim. Bam can handle. Lowry can screen. One of the things that people liked the most of that I've ever written was when I wrote about the Raptors a couple of years ago at The Ringer, and I called Lowry a malevolent fire hydrant because of the way he set screens, and people in Toronto really enjoyed that. I enjoyed it too because I like the sound of my own voice. Anyway, the broader point is, I think that there's a lot of options for the way that Spoelstra can solve problems on offense, even if their offense has not been elite this season. And I think if you pair a lot of ways to solve problems with a defense that I think is going to be great pretty much no matter who's on the floor and no matter who they have to deal with, I think there's a recipe there for a team that maybe could, as you mentioned earlier, jump out of this tier and into the one above it.
Not only is there a recipe, I don't think there's a coach on this list, maybe even in the whole league, who I trust more to find it than Spoelstra. Mm-hmm. Proven, excellent playoff coach. That goes a long way. And maybe you're even to the point of making me regret not having them number one. That was a very convincing argument there.
It'd be boring if we agreed on everything, man. We had a lot of the ones in the same spot. This is good.
Yeah. This is good content for the people who aren't fans of those few teams at the bottom who stopped listening immediately. This team is going to be nasty defensively in the playoffs with Lowry, Butler, Bam, PJ Tucker. I'd pray to be whichever player gets to be covered by Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero, whoever that is. The rest, it's just going to be brutal. This is not going to be a fun team to play. I question how translatable some of the things they've done this year. Excellent to get them to this first record. Or the best record in the East, how well some of that's going to translate now that they're getting to full strength. You know, what is Omer Yurtseven, who's played well for them, what is his role going to be now that Bam is back? You know, what is Max Strus going to contribute now that Duncan Robinson is shooting better? You know, Gabe Vincent, I think there's a role for him as a backup. I think there's a small role for Caleb Martin, too. But some of this, these things that have worked in the regular season, I think some of those can go away. I'm also... not completely, I think this will be fine. I think we've seen enough of this already, but not completely ruling out the idea of like, ooh, I'm not so sure how these pieces of their top players fit together. Small sample size, not just because of that. It's also on paper, like, are you going to have enough shooting, enough spacing? Mm-hmm. We have Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo on the court. PJ Tucker making a great clip of his threes doesn't get a ton up. You know, what's going to be the spacing? And he's on the court also. And I think that's where you're going to have to go to be this top team. Those are your top lineups. They're going to have at least two of them the two shoot the worst in Butler and Adebayo. But also Jimmy Butler sometimes just like, nah, I'm not interested in 3-point shooting. Sometimes in the playoffs he can raise his level and make those threes. One of the things I enjoyed the most about in your article was about the ways that Bam Adebayo can raise the ceiling of their offense. You know, he does it as a creator from the top of the post. Like, they didn't have that. It's one of the reasons we've been down on their offense is that their backup bigs, aside from PJ Tucker, they just couldn't recreate that. The your seven and Dwayne Dedman, that's not their game. And so I can see a higher ceiling in the half court offense than they've had, a decently higher ceiling, but I can't see an elite ceiling, and that gives me a little bit of caution opposed to the team where I had them right behind the Jazz. The Jazz, I got no doubts, they can have that elite offense.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think to point to the swing pieces for this offense in the context of a postseason series, I think it's can Bam be that like perpetual mismatch creator, whether he's like bullying a smaller defender that gets him or facing up and driving around a more lumbering big. One of the sort of, we haven't talked about it as much, one of the quieter, bigger disappointments of their series against the Bucks last year was just he really did not know what to do with Brook Lopez hanging off of him in the paint and like planting himself at the rim and saying, all right, shoot the mid-range or drive at me, and I'm not really too worried about it. And it felt like a boxer who couldn't really get the range of his opponent's jab, and so Bam seemed like he was off balance the entire series as they got smoked. But if Bam is the guy he's been over the last month, where it's more aggressive, it's more looking to get to the rim, get to the paint, he doesn't have to do quite as much of the facilitation from the elbows because Lowry's there to handle a lot of that. And, Hero will be able to handle a lot of that. Jimmy handles a lot of that. So it's all right. You need to get downhill and you need to get to the rim and you need to make some more things happen. If he can do that, I think that elevates their chances of making mismatches and getting good looks in the half court. I think Lowry has been, I've said this before, and this is maybe an unfair or like a low estimation. The way I always used to think of Jimmy Butler is as like 85% of Kawhi Leonard. And I don't know if that's fair. Maybe the number is higher now. It probably should be higher because, Jimmy's established himself as a legit top 10 guy. But Lowry as the guy who was like, I'm going to let Kawhi just kind of run everything. Like, there's the Kawhi offense, and then when it's time for me to sort of get in and be the aggressor and take more shots, that really made the Raptors sing to a certain degree. And whether Lowry's capable of doing that same thing a few years later, will remain to be seen. But I think he can crank up the volume of threes to create some more of that space. He can be a guy you can trust to create and pick and roll or get a shot late in the clock. I think that he has maybe not quite shown all of what he can do quite yet. And then Hero, the version of Hero they had in the bubble is a big reason they went to the finals. The version of Hero they had last year is a big reason they went out in round one. He's been much closer to the former this season, and so long as he does not regress to the latter in the spring, I think that gives them a really good chance of being able to create well enough to fend off some of those great defenses they're going to have to deal with. But a lot, as you say, that's me saying here's three huge ifs. Right? Like all of these teams, they're so like fantastic teams that all have multiple like big ifs to deal with, because that's, there's no super team right now. There's no foolproof answer. But I'm optimistic that that's going to lead to like some really, really fascinating series early in the playoffs and maybe some matchups that we might not have seen coming.
That was a fantastic in-depth breakdown of the Miami Heat. And I really mean this when I say it is just a sliver of everything Dan wrote about in his article on The Ringer. I highly recommend reading that to understand Miami better. It's great. It's great. It's great in depth on a team that, all right, so what's the verdict here? Are you saying they don't belong in this tier? It was a mistake to put them here. They belong in that top tier, or do they belong as the top of this tier?
Oh man. So the East above them, it's Miami, Philly, or it's Milwaukee, Philly, who else?
Brooklyn.
I would replace Brooklyn with them. I don't mean to be rude. As I sit here in Brooklyn, New York, by the way, I don't mean to be rude. I would like to see the Nets play well for an extended period of time with the players on their roster for the first time in about 2 months. Can I have that? Can we have that before we start? Before we start planning the parade route down Atlantic Avenue? If you can tell me when Kevin Durant's going to be 100% healthy, when Ben Simmons is going to play, and how many games Kyrie Irving will be available for, I would feel a lot more confident putting them in that like championship caliber ceiling. I might swap those two, but full strength ratings, the Nets belong up there, but I think the Heat have put themselves into that discussion for sure.
So that's just huge hate on the Nets. How dare you? But the Nets are fun. That's fun because you could talk about them in the Championship Contenders podcast. You could also talk about them in the Play-In podcast.
That's exactly right.
Everyone else besides Miami is in between to me. Dan, thanks for coming on. I really enjoyed the discussion. And everybody else, go read his article on the Heat.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, I'm at theringer.com. You can catch me on Twitter at your man divine, sharing links and little jokes. And Dan, it was a pleasure to do this. Thanks so much for having me.